You are listening to African Perspectives with host Brother Oshi on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
What are you gonna do?
Do you really think that?
Do you think it all?
Yeah. Government cares about
they
you.
Ain't giving up a second thought about you. No. Ghetto people.
Who you gonna turn to next?
Tell
ghetto
me. With your life
running like a red disease,
running like a red disease. Ghetto people,
stop giving up yourself.
Stop doing what you're doing to yourself, young. You got to learn to love yourself.
You are listening to African Perspectives, where we view the issues of our day from an African worldview and African-centered perspective. This program is unapologetically African. It is a custom in the African tradition to ask elders for permission to speak, having been granted permission. To our ancestors, whose shoulders we stand on, to our elders, whose shadows we walk in, I greet you, my dear brothers and sisters. In the language of one of the greatest civilizations on this planet, it gave the world the basic disciplines of knowledge of science, math, architecture, music, writing, law, religion, you name it, we did it. The Greeks called it Egypt, but they called themselves Kemet, and Kemet means land of the blacks. I greet you all in the Kemetic language, the word of peace, Hotep. It is truly an honor and a privilege to pour libation because we truly do stand on the shoulders of those who came before us. We're going to use water because water has no enemies. Water is the great cleanser, the great purifier. Everything on the planet that lives, it needs water, from a tiny microscopic organism to a tall redwood tree. We pour water into the earth to invoke the spirits of our ancestors, and we say the word Ashe, which simply means so be it. So we pour this libation to God for all that God has done and for all that God will do. We say Ashe. We pour this libation to Mother Africa, birthplace of all humanity, everyone who has lived, everyone who will live in the future. We all have a common ancestral root in Africa. We pour this libation to the classical civilizations of Africa. I mentioned Kemet in the opening. Kemet was the height, the apex, the zenith of African high culture. But there were others as well, as Timari, Punt, and Nubia. So we pour this libation to the classical civilizations of Africa. We say Ashe. We pour this libation to the contemporary civilizations of Africa, of Ghana, Mali, Songhai, Benin, Great Zimbabwe, civilizations that were flourishing and growing while Europe was in a medieval or dark age. The University of Sankore at Timbuktu, an outstanding educational institution. So we pour this libation to the contemporary civilizations of Africa. We say Ashe. We pour this libation to the Maafa, the Holocaust of our enslavement, the Infakani, the great tragedy, uprooted out of Africa. Our brothers and sisters lay a carpet along the Atlantic Ocean. We're in North America, South America, Central America, and throughout the diaspora. So we pour this libation to our brothers and sisters who suffered the Maafa, the Infakani, the Holocaust of our enslavement, the great tragedy. We pour this libation in their honor and in their memory. We do not know their names, but because of them and their sacrifice, we are here. So we say Ashe. We pour this libation to those who fought against enslavement. If you ever heard me do a libation, you will know that we were not slaves. I repeat, we were not slaves. We were captives. What does a captive want to do? Get free. So we pour this libation to all those men and women who fought against enslavement. In fact, I maintain that some of us are more of a slave today than we were in our initial captivity, because some of us are a slave to vice, to corruption, to drugs, sex, and violence. So we pour this libation to those who fought against enslavement, Gabriel Prosser, Nat Turner, Dingmark Vesey, Harriet Tubman. We always resisted. And we will always resist. So we pour this libation in the name and the honor of those men and women who fought against our captivity. We pour this libation to those unborn, those young men and women who will once again lead us back on the stage of human history as a free and proud and productive people. We sashay. We pour this libation to brotherhood and sisterhood, together for the union of family. We need each other. We don't have good family life. There's a saying, conditions shape conduct and consciousness. The conditions in our community are bad. The conduct towards each other is not good. Because why? We lack consciousness. And consciousness is more than just awareness. Consciousness is a deeper understanding of who you are historically, who you are culturally. So once we begin to understand the importance of brotherhood and sisterhood together for the union of family. Brothers and sisters, let us all say, Ashe, Ashe.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
Good morning, African world. You are listening to African Perspectives here on the Motherland Media Network, on timeforanawakening.com and blacktalkradionetwork.com. And I am your host, Brother Oshi. Hotep family, hope everything is well for you today. Hope you're going to have a great weekend. I hope you get a chance to do all the things you want to do, must do, can do, and will do. And I hope the weather will be accommodating for you to do it. But of course, if it's not, and it has to be done, and it must be done, you're going to get it done. And that's why we love you and appreciate you. And you'll do it safely. So get it done. This is African Perspectives, and we have one of our esteemed guests, Baba Barudi. So I'm going to read the Enye Sesem. I'm going to forego many of the announcements that I do. And so we can have that much time with our guests, and because his time is limited. And we appreciate him for allowing us this time. I'm going to read 3 days of the Enye Sesem, yesterday, today, and tomorrow. And, of course, the Enye Sesem is revolutionary thought. April 8th. Many of the primal mother figures which personify fertility, voluptuousness, and rebirth have been exhumed from the grave sites of man, and women have arms which transform into wings. For the original African woman was the first being to be identified with wings. The ancients believed she was connecting link between heaven and earth, the intermediate between time and eternity. She was the first divine messenger of the cosmic Godhead, the source of light and wisdom called Ma'at in the ancient Kemetic, in ancient Kemet, and wisdom in the Hebrew scriptures. Ashaka Musa, Bear Shango. I share a birthday with Baba Bear Shango, this great scholar, warrior scholar, and ancestor, April 27th. It's an honor, Baba Bear Shango. We honor African warrior women because they believe in the righteousness of our fight for African sovereignty and are fully engaged in the frontline work of this uncompromising struggle to be who we naturally are. We honor them because of their resilience in the face of an unrelenting parasitic enemy and the struggles that they must daily overcome with those in the conscious community and beyond whose fear, ignorance, and personal weaknesses cause them to act out their menticide against us. We honor our sisters because of the incomparable beauty they possess and so effortlessly express physically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually in just being their natural African selves. Ashe. We honor them because they are the bearers and first teachers and feminine nurturers of the warriors in training that we have chosen to create and rear together. We honor them because they honor us by standing with us and setting a standard for us that is more than worthy of us as a people and sacred vision we hold for our children's children, children's great-grandchildren. We honor them because they are ours as we are theirs. Affirm, I honor African warrior women. Affirm, I honor African warrior women. April 9th. A serial killer or child molester or drug addicted don't actually stop being what they are between crimes.
They just ain't doing their thing at a particular moment. Clearly, to understand or treat such serious problems, our focus must be enlarged far beyond moments of dramatic explosions to identify patterns, anticipate eruptions, seek root causes and means of prevention. Yet we address Caucasian prejudice and violence directed at African people as a series of unfortunate incidents, deviancy from an Enlightenment norm. John Edgar Wideman. Whatever Urugu does, it is feeding something inside, whether conscious or not. It is designed to fulfill the imperatives which move everyone toward them and their way. And for warriors, whether this is conscious or not, whether they mean it or not, is irrelevant. What is important is that it negatively cumulatively affects us. It may be murder, child stealing, diseducation, cultural banditry, financing misorganizations or misleaders within our community, revolutionary or otherwise, or any other thing in the collective acts against others. It is done to serve their cultural ceiling and cultural imperatives. Regardless of how benevolent, beneficial, and altruistic their giving may appear, it serves their end. Nothing is accidental in this reality. Our destruction has vision. Urugu would have us believe that their ongoing inhumanity is a natural and necessary process in an evolving humanity. But we know that Urugu engineers chaos. We know that they have created reality out of what and who they are. Affirm, I do not get caught up in momentary words or actions. I study historical patterns. Affirm, I do not get caught up in momentary words or actions. I study historical patterns. April 10th. Rotten scum has found its way to power. Time to protect, projects, check the hour. I'm fed worse than just angry. Ready for action, baby. Nothing's getting lazy. Not going crazy. Cause I'm making something happen. Cause I'm gonna make something happen. Ronnie Jordan. What makes us think that we can breathe the same air as a disease and not become infected? What makes us think that the past would forgive us and forget us? What makes us think that children who are known for their genius would not recognize punks pretending to be adults? What makes us think that we can escape this madness without removing it? What makes us think that complementarity is optional for warriors? What makes us think that RBG, the red, black, and green, is a decoration? What makes us think that sovereignty is an endless debate rather than a conscious, concerted action? What makes us think that the enslavement of Africans ever ended, or if it had, that we cannot easily be re-enslaved? What makes us think Urugu could ever change its nature? What makes us think that they would not violate our children? What makes us think that we have time to play? We ain't got no damn time to play. Affirm, I'm gonna make something happen. Affirm, I'm gonna make something happen. The Inye Say Sim of Daily Revolutionary Thought. And I'm blessed and fortunate to have the author of that book. This is Inye Say Sim, volume number 2. And I read this on this program every time we have a program, and I always will. I may even go around and, you know, go back to the first one and back to the second one after years. Who knows? Baba Baruti, good morning.
Sure. Good morning, Baba Oshi. Good to be here. Good to hear your voice.
Oh, you too, dear brother. I know you're busy, man, so I'd really appreciate this time. You know, I know that.
And, you know, we all are doing our different things in different ways, but doing it collectively.
So that's right.
I'm honored to be here. It's good to take this time and be with family.
That's right. Right on. We appreciate that. We got a lot of folks that have called in already. Man, well, I sent out some good information. I said, hey, we got Baba Baruti on today, and so we're going to take advantage of this time that he's allotted us and get our good information. You know,
absolutely, and I'm honored by the presence of warriors. Yeah, always,
yeah, definitely.
Who measures, you know, the quality of your character? Those people, you know, who you respect, who you hold on high, those people who you work for.
Right.
And they respect you, you know, enough said.
Yeah. Well, you know yourself, when I first came here, you know, you probably definitely don't remember when I met you back in Milwaukee. When
yes, I do.
Oh, do you? Yeah, because yeah. Queenie
came
Fama.
Up to do homosexuality lecture.
Sure did. That's right. At the African Women's Center. And
yes, indeed.
Yep. My dear friend, Queenie Fama, she made her transition about 5 years ago now, 4 years ago, whatever. And she's the one that brought you there to Milwaukee. And I
miss her. She was energy.
Yes. Yes, she was. Talking about sure a warrior. Did. Talking about a warrior queen. Yes.
Absolutely.
Believe
Absolutely.
Me.
She did not play.
No, not at all. And, you know, and been following you ever since. And, of course, when I got here, you know, reintroduced myself and been, you know, somebody who supports you and supports the work that you do, you know, believe me, it is tremendously necessary for our liberation and self-determination and sovereignty that we seek as African people. And I'm glad to be a part of that. I'm glad to be working with that because I believe in that. You know, and one of the things that when I got here just about a year ago, less than that, is Baba Kelsey. Baba Kelsey mm-hmm. gave me a compliment. He said, I've been seeing you. You know, maybe sometimes people come into the community and, you know, they may be agent provocateurs. They may talk a good game. They may be dressed mm-hmm. down in grand boobas and got mm-hmm. lakey beads all over and everything like that, you know. Mm-hmm. But he said, I seen you and I seen how consistent you are, and I respect. And I said, "Wow, that's coming from who I consider an esteemed elder. He's right. an esteemed. I mean, you're talking about somebody who's 94, I believe, who is still on the case. Who is still, you know, he ain't out the pastor. He ain't like, well, I put my time in. Let me go sit down. You know, so he's still doing the work because he still believes, and I hope to be doing this too." You know, I expire, you know.
Long time.
Yeah, I hope so, Baba Rudy. And you yeah, too,
absolutely.
Dear brother.
No such thing as retirement on the front line.
That's right. That's right. You and know, that's
until
what we
it's
are.
Over. I mean, when it's over, when African people are in sovereign and we're in control of our reality and no one can interfere with that, then we can start talking about some retirement plans.
Yeah. But until that.
But as of this moment, like you were saying with you in your libation, we're our communities are in trouble.
Yeah.
And as long as they're in trouble, then we have work to do. And sure. those folks who are not doing any work, then they're contributing to that difficulty. They're contributing mm-hmm. to that problem.
Yeah.
And I don't think you or I don't think, I know neither you nor I want to be part of that. Neither one of us wants to be a contributor
no.
to that insanity.
No, not, oh, no way. No way. In fact, you know, when I'm out here in the community and wherever I am, I always romanticize and visualize African sovereignty and what it would happen, how it would happen and what it would look like for us. I know it's not happening here. This is the,
right.
you know, this is a hell of a place. This is, you know, I remember, what's her name? Donna Summers in her song, mm-hmm. America, the Land of the Dream. You know, I want to get to America, mm-hmm. the Land of the Dream and the vision of America. To me, this is mm-hmm. a evil place. It is an evil place, you know, because of what
it's in an evil place. Yeah. You know, only evil is rewarded.
Yeah.
And there's no, I mean, I see the frustration in, you know, a lot of warriors' eyes from time to time. It's not, you know, continuous, but I see it from time to time. Mm-hmm. And they are feeling what you just said. You know, they're putting in this time. They're putting in this work. They're doing, each one of them doing the work of thousands of men and women by themselves. And yet they look around and they see the chaos growing. And, of course, we have to be reminded, this is not our reality. This is not our space. And until we create our own reality, however long that may take, mm-hmm. until we create our own reality, then this is what we're going to see. Because we don't run this bad boy.
No.
You know, this is the evil runs this bad boy. And I can't put in any other words.
Yeah,
it is straight up evil relative to African people. This is about as anti-African as you can get. This is about as anti-human as you can get. This is about as anti-divine
and
as
see,
you can get.
And the problem for us is that we don't understand it and we don't want to see it. You know, it's just
right.
like that saying, if we knew better, we'd do better. A lot of us don't want to know better, because by knowing better, your attitude and your behavior has to change if you know better. So we don't want to know. We want to continue with the illusion of inclusion. We want to continue to fight for these rights that we say and all this other madness.
You gain sovereignty. You don't have to worry about any of that.
That's right.
So the only questions for me that warriors should have is how to pursue this sovereignty. What, you know, talents do I have? What skills do I have? What knowledge do I have? What can I do where I stand, boots on the ground? What can I do here, right where I'm at? And what, you know, is going to evolve out of this that is going to move us towards sovereignty? Everything that we think, everything we do, you know, everything from the toothpaste that we use to the books that we read, everything should be directed toward sovereignty. You know, Bob, it reminds the idea of that, which is not new, it's ancient. The idea of that reminds me of papers that students would do when they were seniors in high school or freshmen in college on something that, you know, they were really interested in and was important. And I would tell them, you know, you continue to take that paper that you just wrote and you expand on it. So when you become a sophomore, when you become a junior, when you become a senior, each year that paper is going to progress. So if you decide to go to grad school, by the time you get there, you really already got your thesis and you've already got your focus in one direction, and you continue to increase the quality of that focus. And for me, that's like sovereignty.
Right.
For
right
warriors. On. You know, whatever they're doing, everything needs to be directed toward that, and it makes their movement towards, our movement towards sovereignty even stronger. But a lot of our warriors either think that they're not doing enough, or the visibility of losing is disarming. It can be anti-motivational. Because we're human and we want to win. And the stress from this, which is what Yoruba relies on, they rely heavily on our stress, on the level of stress that we receive, which in some cases can turn people into quitters.
Yeah. No doubt. Because, see, you know, you're bombarded 24/7, 365 in this madness, you know.
Absolutely.
And so therefore, you know, it breaks you down if you're not fortified, if you're not infused with that knowledge, you know, and that spirit and that understanding of, regardless of whatever happens, I'm going to overcome this madness and I'm going to persevere for my people and for myself and my family and my future, you know.
Indeed. I guess for me, many, many years ago, when I was trying to figure out this religious spiritual thing, decades ago, I was trying to figure this out for me. And I essentially came to the conclusion, you know, that I'm an African, and of course, we're trying to create sovereignty for African people. And in terms of my thought, my behavior, my words, I looked at it not as something, well, it was something that was real, but I needed something in my mind that would sort of regulate any questions that I had. And I said, okay, when I'm through, when I go before that great board of ancestors, you know, what is going to be the judgment? And that's got to be, you know, our only measuring rod. You know, what are the ancestors going to say when it's all said and done, when we make that transition, will we have contributed more toward the sovereignty of African people or not? That to me is the only measuring rod. Of course, the only people who can measure that are warriors who have transitioned from sovereignness themselves. But for me, it's that drive, that motivation, that need to not quit, that desire to not quit, not quitting. that has to. Sometimes you're going to be alone in that. You know, sometimes you're going to be by yourself in this fight, even if you have a compliment. Sometimes you're going to be, you know, alone in this battle, and you have to have something that you can hold on to in the process, because what Yoruba is set up in place, and that's not the, obviously warriors are weak, but when Yoruba is set up in place, Yoruba is good. They're good at being evil. They're excellent. If they weren't, then they wouldn't have us in the position that we're in right now. They're good. You know, we can call them stupid all we want to, but if they were, then we wouldn't be in the position where we are. We wouldn't be having this conversation right now.
Right.
So, you know, Warriors have to have something that is bigger and stronger than them that they look to or that they are linked to that will allow them, you know, to go into funks or to be unhappy about certain situations but still come out of it stronger. Mm-hmm. And to be able to work even harder, you know, from that position. If that's in place, it doesn't make a difference how bad it gets. It doesn't make a difference, you know, the pain involved and the treason from those folks who, you know, you're talking about who are African down in their attire.
Mm-hmm.
It won't make a difference, you know, what they do, what they say, or how bad you feel about it, because you know when it's over, when push comes to shove, you're going to be stronger than before. You're going to be fighting even harder than, you know, for African sovereignty for us.
Because mm-hmm. that's our future. I don't believe that our ancestors, you know, particularly those who were in captivity, mm-hmm. wanted us to try to wear down Caucasians and put into them a moral persuasion, you know, that would wear them down and make them have an epiphany about what they have done and then allow us to be a part of this madness. I don't believe that, you know.
No.
I don't believe our ancestors. I believe our ancestors still clinged to us being who we are as Africans and wanted us to fight for sovereignty. That's my feeling. And I came to this some time ago, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I've been thinking this and feeling this for many years, many decades. I mean, because I used to be vice president of the NAACP, you know. I used to be, you know, marching and so forth and demonstrating,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
But,
mm-hmm.
you know, to me, I ain't saying that's passe, but that's irrelevant for mm-hmm. us to gain the things that we want to gain as African people. And that's what we must do.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And when we do those things, and most of us are doing those things, but when we do those things, it works right into Urugu's hand because it keeps them at our center.
Mm-hmm.
All of our activities, all of our thoughts, all of our efforts to get free center around them allowing us to, center around them as being the ideal type, center around their type of society as being the model for quote-unquote humanity. So when we do those things, we are, again, keeping them at our center, and that's what people really need to be aware of, need to think about. There was a very short, interesting conversation I was having with a colleague on the porch maybe about 20 years ago, and we were talking about Urugu and the devastation on the planet. We were on the porch talking about this, and he made a very profound statement. He said, "We're here. You know, Urugu is nowhere near. We're standing here on the porch, and Urugu is still in our space."
Mm.
We're still, you know, the center of our discussion.
Mm-hmm.
We're still concerned about, you know, them. We're still not us at that time, but it took me on to thinking, you know, we're trying to make everything that we do Urugu friendly. We're judging like this reparations issue. We are trying to determine what we can get based upon what they are willing to give.
Mm-hmm.
I have to stop sometimes and think, if I had all the wherewithal or we had the wherewithal to do whatever we wanted to, what would we want in any given situation? What would be the outcome of any situation if we were true to ourselves, if we were true to those ancestors you're talking about? If we were actually true to them, you know, do or die. If we can't do it the African way, then, you know, the hell with it. You know,
mm-hmm.
we're gone, because we're not going to be anything but African. What would be the decision? What would we do? What would we actually do? And most of us don't put that at the forefront. We're trying to find ways to safely compromise. And there's a quote by Baba Hannibal Afrique, which I really love in terms of compromise. He said, "Once you are compromised, one compromise leads to another and another and another, you know, and another and another and another."
Mm-hmm.
So it's like our minds are in a state of compromise.
Yeah.
So we're trying to find the best possible compromises which allow us to think that we're being African versus us deciding or understanding completely and totally, okay, this is African behavior. This will be the African action here. This will be, no, we're still trying to find ways to be comfortable within this reality. We're still trying to find a way to make compromise seem like it's progress, like we're actually moving forward, like we're actually doing something. But all the time, we're still keeping Urugu at the center mm-hmm. of our concern. Remains always at the center of our concern. It's like whatever we do relative to race relations, if you will, relative to the education of our children, relative to the empowerment of African communities, relative to police shootings, all kinds of different kinds of shootings. I don't want to just lay it on the lap of police because, you know, they're all a police force. But relative to the destruction of African people, we're trying to find a way to make what we say not offensive to Urugu. I could care less.
I hear you. I say.
Yeah. You know. Folks who know me know better.
Yeah.
But that keeps them at the center. And it compromises. It modifies our thoughts to the point where they work against us.
Mm-hmm. And the problem that we have is that we can't step outside of those imposed boundaries that the European has put on us,
mm-hmm.
you know, to look at them for who and what they are. You know, I use this analogy that there is the European has put a vice grip on our minds. Everything that we are talking about, Baba, as you know, is mm-hmm. mental. It is the mind. We're at war for the minds of our people. And we have been warred upon, but our minds have been so warped by Urugu is that we can't fathom that, you know?
Right.
You know, so once that vice grip, if you understand that tool, once the vice grip is set, I don't give a damn how strong you think you are. You can't open that vice grip up. The knob at the end of the handle of the vice grip, you turn that knob. And the more knowledge you have of yourself, of your culture, of your tradition, of your history and who you are, you continue to turn that knob until finally it releases the vice grip. Now you see the Caucasian for who and what they are, but you don't challenge them. To hell with them. In fact, there's nothing you can do or say. What you do is we come together and challenge each other to be independent, to be self-determining, mm-hmm. to be liberated, to be sovereign, and work towards that. And that's what we do. And you can, and you'll see that vision once you have done that. But
absolutely,
you know,
becomes crystal clear.
Yes.
And you said that vice grip, that's a serious thing. And the point that you made, which is something a lot of people overlook, even when you unscrew that vice grip and get your mind out of it, many of us don't take what we've learned, what we know, what we understand, our power, and apply it.
Right, right.
Against that hand and toward ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
It's got to go both ways. You get folks who have arguments where we got to get rid of Urugu, or you got arguments to say, you know, we need to leave Urugu alone and do our thing. You can't do either separately. They have to be done together.
Yeah.
Okay. Because you can't just say, well, we're just going to work on ourselves and ignore Urugu, because Urugu is invasive.
Yes.
There's no boundaries.
No.
And when it sees somebody or something leaving its control, it's going after it.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to build, you know, on both ways, so that, you know, these things always take us back to the wisdom of our ancestors. And one thing I've been talking about a lot lately is the idea of wisdom. And our ancestors, you know, they said, you know, you can be knowledgeable, you can be extremely well-read, you can, you know, all of this stuff, you know, you're a brilliant person. But if you don't apply that wisdom to the benefit of the community, then you're not wise, you're stupid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that applying that wisdom. Wisdom is half defined if it's not applied. If it's not put to work for the study of our people. And part of that wisdom also comes from us reversing this Eurocentric social science notion of studying the problem. Of course we study the problem. You always study the problem. That's supposedly the purpose of study, really, because you're trying to solve things. You're trying to gain answers. But the problem is with our misdefinition of what the problem is. We're walking around studying black folks when the problem is Urugu.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to understand Urugu. If we understand, Arthur Schomburg talked about that.
Yeah.
You know, he's telling Harry Clark, you know, first thing you need to do is you need to study Urugu, because when you understand your enemy, then you understand why we're in the position that we're in.
Mm-hmm. And see that.
And we don't want to take the time to do that.
Right. And see, our problem is I know unfortunately, a number of people who consistently blame us. And of course, they know me, and their consensus is, oh, there you go again, blaming white folks. You damn right. Because they're the crux of the problem. They're the root of the problem. You damn right I'm blaming white folks. You know, but they talk really bad about us, that we're incompetent, we can't do this, we do this in our community, we're morally bankrupt, all these other things, because they have really bought into what Urugu has designed for us. And they bought into it and they perpetuate it, you know. And so, that you know, to me, I challenge us. I mean, the hell with Urugu. We know what they're about. If you know your enemy, you know what they're about. I'm trying to make us wake up. You know, we're going to talk about reparations. And one of the issues that I understand, for me, I've been a part of National Coalition for Blacks for Reparations in America. I'm a member of the National Black United Front, many organizations that push and promote reparations. But I looked at reparations, you know, in terms of repair, to repair our people and repair and build institutions that further that repair for us to be sovereign. Many of our people look at reparations as a check, has some money for the suffering of our people. And I understand that. And I understand too, Baba, that there are some of us who have been impoverished for generations in this country, for generations by design, you know, and for them to get some money. In fact, there was a piece on the news this morning about how the Los Angeles County, whoever at the time, stole these people's property. They paid the money. There's all that. And then under eminent domain, they stole these people's property. You know, back in the early 1900s, they had a beachfront property that many of us could go to at that time who lived in that area, because they couldn't obviously go to the Caucasians. In fact, they had to walk miles to get to the to their beach, you know. But I'm saying is that there are many of those kinds of examples, and that history is repeated and consistent. But the thing is that, you know, do we continue to fight for that? And I know, I don't know if you heard about this, Baba, but Evanston, Illinois. Evanston, Illinois, you heard about that. They won reparations through their council because of the redlining and gerrymandering that happened to them early last century, where they were directed toward this community and they lost generational wealth, they lost property values and so forth. And so they're trying to make an amends for that. And that's nice. And that's fine for them. You know, you know, but to me, reparations is not what happened to an individual. Reparations for me is what happened to us collectively as African people.
Absolutely. And that's, you're talking about so many of the issues that I have with the movement, you know, and I've been watching it for a few decades. And the thing I don't like that I see is this watering down of the demands, or keeping them constant, if you will, where they don't change. Everybody focuses on that check, as you say, that little check, you know, relative to what was lost. And of course, there's a whole lot involved in that discussion, because when you start trying to calculate the money, then I'm not talking about a 9-to-5, if we want to get into that discussion. I'm not talking about a 9-to-5. These Africans were working or on call 24/7. You know, there wasn't this, you know, certain wage, and we can't do the minimum wage thing, because most of us who came over here were skilled.
Yeah.
There's a difference between the wage labor of skilled workers versus unskilled workers, and they're calculating it based upon unskilled workers
In
many cases.
Exactly.
And I believe it was Swinton years ago who made the point that, you know, America doesn't have enough. Doesn't have enough money. Doesn't have enough land. Doesn't have enough manufacturing infrastructure to pay Africans for what was lost to us. And that has to be considered in the context of the people. You made the point of using the word repair, which a lot of people, I don't know, we use words and we don't think about what they mean, or we don't have good synonyms for them in our thinking. Repair, to me, is the one, probably the synonym, if you will, that's ignored the most. but it means the most, because reparations isn't supposed to correct the issue. Reparations is supposed to set the stage, or set part of the stage, or provide some of the resources or what have you that are necessary for people to rebuild themselves. You said challenge ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So this is, the reparations would be nothing but money, resources, et cetera, that would allow us the seed money to do what it was that we need to do for ourselves. But for me, that's a very, very small part of the reparations. The cash, the money part, that's a very, very small part of the reparations, because to me also, the concept of reparations has been made user-friendly, or never came out of being user-friendly for Yoruba. I keep saying that because it has. It is always considered either the possibility that Yoruba would pay, or the possibility of what Yoruba would be willing to pay, or what would be fair to Yoruba, which I could care less what is fair to Yoruba.
Yes.
So when we're talking about reparations, then first and foremost, we have to talk about something that is going to help facilitate the correction of past, present, and future structural and personal racism. Okay, not just what happened during the time of our enslavement. You use the word, I keep coming back to you, Bob, because you're calling out the points. You use the word ma'afa.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Reparations is supposed to provide a piece of a foundation that's going to begin our process, or extend our process of correcting ourselves. We have to look at all kinds of aspects of reparations. So I guess for me, the word subsidize may be a good word for what reparations are supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
But it's got to provide the framework out of which historical lies can be corrected. All of these things affect the people's ability, their self-perception, their ability to thrive. So it's not just the money. We, you know, of course, we heard the arguments, you know, you give black folks all of this money, what's going to happen? It's going to be out of their hands tomorrow, because they're going to go and spend it all on white stuff.
Yeah.
That mind that's going to do that has to be part of the reparations process.
Mm-hmm.
I ask the students all the time, what did it take for African people to be like those civilizations that you talked about? Those empires that you talked about, what did it take for us to go from that to where we're at now?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That didn't happen financially. You know, that was financially a part of it. Of course, everything was stolen from us. But the vast majority of that was mental.
Mental, yes.
The vast majority of that was the destruction of the African mind. Mm-hmm. So when you talk about reparations, then mm-hmm. you have to correct historical lies, one aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
You have to correct... have a means by which to correct mental psychological damage. Okay, not just post-traumatic slave syndrome, but all the way back to the point of the invasion and our capture through today, even though, of course, that's important. But the entire thing, we're trying to look at bits and pieces of it. So we also have to get rid of, do something. I mean, how do you correct for these stereotypes? We're gonna, emotional retardation. In your libation, men and women need to learn how to get along. How do we get to the point where we hate each other?
Yeah.
Okay, that has to be incorporated in it, because reparations are supposed to repair us to the point, or going to set the stage so that we are repaired to the point where we are normal Africans again. And we're not talking about something that can be done in a generation or two or three. I think black people are very limited in their idea of reparations, because mm-hmm. they think that everything is going to be fine with Yoruba, because they think that they can, as you said, work them into their moral, a good moral state, so we can all get along, work them to a point where they'll see us as brothers and sisters, their brothers and sisters, and start treating us from a position of power, which of course is another part of the equation, because if you're coming to the table asking for reparations and you don't have any power,
right, you're going to get crumbs.
You don't have any collective power, then you're not coming to negotiate. You're coming to be told what to do.
Right. You're coming in to beg.
You're coming to beg.
You know, I mentioned this before in discussing reparations. When I was sitting at the firehouse table, back in, I think this is the 80s, early 80s, whatever, a columnist named George Cutheimer, he was an editorial columnist. I'm not sure if he was with Washington or New York Times, whatever. Don't make the difference. But this Caucasian said, we should give them reparations. We gave them, because this is coming out on the heels of affirmative action, which I came on the fire department with. So we gave them welfare. We gave them affirmative action. We gave them this. We gave them that. We should give them wealth. We should give them reparations because of the mindset that they have. Let's say we give them 40,000 a family and 20,000 an individual. But the mindset that they have, you know, we'll get that back. In fact, it's just like what you just got in the mail, a stimulus. That's what it would be. Yeah. It would be a stimulus package for the economy. It was you would buy Cadillacs and clothes and this. You won't pull that money together to build a school independent. Yeah. You won't pull that money together to provide a job or develop a strip mall where there's businesses that we have. You won't do that. We'll get that money right back. And once that's done, you shut the hell up. I don't want to hear about nothing. There ain't going to be no class action suits. And if you don't have corroborating evidence about you being discriminated against, shut the hell up, you know.
Absolutely. They know exactly what they're doing. They're like, an apology.
Yeah.
We don't get it. So that mindset, that mental side has to be corrected. To me, that's got to be the first part of a reparations package, if you will, where... I was sitting there thinking years ago, if we received reparations, and say there was an organization that we had that was the distributor of our reparations, and that organization was owned, controlled, regulated by serious, centered warriors who loved African people. So it wasn't, you know, punish this person, punish that person, not give them any money because blah, blah, blah. But those people, their first priority should be to set up a processing center for all African people where you are checked for your mentality and you are given monies or you're given resources based upon how close your ideal is to making a sovereign. Mm-hmm. And the farther you are away from it, then the more re-education, which would be part of that program,
that you're going to need,
would be. And I know this is like a fantasy, but still the idea, if you're talking about repairing African people, I keep coming back to your word, repairing African people, if that's the goal, then that has to start with the mental.
Mm-hmm.
And this process has to begin with changing of people's minds because we are still geared to saving Urugu.
Yeah.
At our expense, we're still geared. So if the money was given to us today, and most of the people I've known in my life, they would instantly jumpstart this economy.
See?
Instantly,
yeah,
instantly. It would not take a week. It wouldn't take a week. And I'm not, you know, trying to be funny or talk down to black folks. We know us. Okay, it's just like a family. You can talk about your family. You might not be able to talk about other families, but you can talk about your family. Nobody else can talk about your family, but you can.
Mm-hmm.
It's like we don't have the mindset because we are so materialistic focused. E. Franklin Frazier's conspicuous consumption, where we're focused on being seen, on having material things that elevate us because all of our prestige, all of our pride, all of our sense of dignity is wrapped up in the things that we have.
Mm-hmm.
So that, because that is still there at the forefront of our mind, Ma'ad is not in the forefront of most of our minds. Building community is not at the forefront of most of our minds. African sovereignty is not at the forefront of most of our minds. Taking care of our own, educating our children correctly is not at the forefront of most of our minds. Okay, so a huge chunk of that money, whatever it may be, needs to go to us creating or being able to take over ourselves. I can see us now starting schools and bringing in maybe a smidgen, but bringing in Urugu faculty who happen to be liberal. We forget the history of their inclusion in anything. That needs to be, I guess, for me, one of the first rules. White folks can't touch it.
That's right.
You know, it gets a lot deeper because, and I don't think this is, a small aside, but people, we get excited when somebody who was murdered by the cops in our community, their family gets, you know, this settlement from the court of, you know, $20 million, what have you, and we forget that in these places which are predominantly black, the tax dollar, the tax base of those areas are black folks. So either that money is coming directly out of our pockets or it's coming out of an insurance policy for that municipal area, that city.
Which comes out of our pockets, too, yeah. Which also comes out of our pockets, right.
When we're talking about reparations, we also have to look at the source. We can't look at the government as a source of the reparations because a huge chunk of the money in the government comes from us, from the exploitation of African people, from our tax dollars, from our overtax dollars. So if we're talking about this having the wherewithal to have whatever it is that we want and to state things without compromise, well, that money needs to come directly out of Urugu's pockets. It can't come from the government. And I know that a lot of people are going to – the government can regulate maybe the extraction of that money from them, but it can't come out of the government because how much of – unless you can somehow separate the money, the tax dollars, the money that black folks have put into the government and continue to put in the government from that white folks have put in the government and continue to put in the government and take the reparations out of their share of the money. Otherwise, we're just paying ourselves back for being exploited.
Exactly. what do you think of
idea of reparations has to be thought at that level. It can't just be how many hours did enslaved Africans work over 12 generations on the plantation. It can't be that simple because there's been no shift in power. It'd be like Zania, South Africa, where you now don't have quote unquote apartheid, but there's been no distribution of any of the wealth. None.
Right. And Caucasians are still running it. I say if you got control of the money and you got control of the military, you running it. I don't give a damn how many dark faces you have in high places. You running it. And that's the same in South Africa as well as in Namibia and other parts. What do you think of ADOS?
Excuse me?
What do you think of ADOS? The descendants of, what do you call it, descendants?
Oh, okay. I thought you said ADOL. I'm saying, okay. I'm not impressed with them in any way, shape, or fashion. In fact, I was just talking to the students about that yesterday because one of the main arguments that is made has to do with the presence of slavers, of the slave ships. You know, you have all of these. I need to find the slide that, and I'm at the computer. I'm trying to look for this slide because the idea, one of their main arguments is you don't see where the slavers at, you know, where the ships that brought us over. So therefore, we weren't brought here from Africa, and I need to find this slide so badly.
I know that I know part of that group's mentality is that that we were always here, and we were taken from here, and sent to Europe, not from Africa. We didn't come, you know, and it's really something that to me is convoluted, you know.
Yeah.
And it doesn't deal with their history.
To me, this is a form of escapism, and there are a number of them that have come on the scene within the last 20 years or so. Mm-hmm. So when I look at them, you try to pick the arguments apart, especially for the young folks, because, you know, not that they'll fall for anything, but they're gullible when you're talking about people who are charismatic, who know how to talk. I was talking to him about that argument in terms of us not having been brought from the continent. And they say, you know, one of the arguments for that, again, is that the wooden ships, and, you know, we need this physical evidence. But you have the ships that transported Europeans from here to here. Where are they at? Model T cars. You know, so because you don't see any Model T cars, therefore there weren't any. We don't see log cabins. We don't see trolley cars. When we travel around, we travel around on planes that have jet engines. So where are the planes with the propellers on them? Therefore, they didn't exist because of that. We look at the length of the structures. I mean, we don't see any of the battleships that were used in World War II. We don't see the battleships that were used in the Civil War or the Revolutionary War. But because the ships, they don't see any wooden ships, which, of course, they're going to decay. They're going to be used for other stuff over time. Because we don't physically see any of those, that is one of the weakest arguments.
Yeah,
that I've ever heard trying to support any idea that because we don't see something that existed 100, what is it? The average lifespan of a house in this country is like 40 years. So because this house, which was built 60 years, no longer exists, therefore the house wasn't there. You know, the weakness of these escapist arguments that are trying to exonerate Urugu, that are trying, because at the heart of these, at the very heart of these arguments is to make Urugu not into something evil anymore.
Right. And also,
you know, we were already here. And in fact, you know, in the Texas history books now, we didn't come here as enslaved Africans. We came as workers looking for employment. You know, so all of this escapism, we need to look at where this is going. So the idea is that soon Urugu will not be at fault for anything.
That's right.
And to just you with the people you're talking about, who I've known some in my life, who are blaming us for everything and taking it out of cultural context because they don't want to go historically to see where things began and how stuff started. They don't understand the idea of trends where you start something, you set something in motion, and it picks up momentum as it goes along. So people lose sight of where it came from, and they think that what they see now is the way that it's always been.
Right.
And what's going on now is the cause. Mm-hmm. This is you know, this escapism, you know, sometimes it really gets on my last nerve.
Well, you know, the ADOS idea that only American Africans can access this money. You'd have to have proven that your family and you had been in captivity, and so anybody coming in, anybody from Africa, anybody from the Caribbean, anybody, they're excluded. Only the American Africans who had suffered this particular hell can access this money, you know. Yeah. And to me, that is so damn divisive, you know, because the reality is that Africans, period. That's why, to me, the whole reparations movement should be international, and it should be dealt with and targeted at religions, Christianity, Islam, Judaism. All of those so-called Abrahamic religions have been enslaving African people and denigrating African people and taking African people's land and resources, you know. So all of that, we got to, you know, we have a hell of a job to do, Baba.
Oh, absolutely.
Yep.
And a huge chunk of that job is, well, part of that job is to ignore folks who do not understand, who do not want to understand. And the other part is to make those who want to understand or do understand crystal clear.
Mm-hmm.
When I talk about this, I say we need an equation, like a mathematical equation. I use that because the young folks, they really understand that. I said we need an equation in which we can plug in honest assessments of what was done to us, so we can begin to look at if there was a dollar amount, and we only want to look at it in money, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
There needs to be an equation where we can really plug in that international thing that you're talking about and what really we should be paid for. I mean, you're talking about an emotional situation, like, you know, how do you calculate?
Mm-hmm.
How do you calculate in dollar amount a black woman who has to nurse white children at the expense of her own children? How do you calculate that into that equation? And I think that needs to be kicked into the equation. That's an idea, an aspect of which we can begin to think about. Okay, how do you calculate what's the cost of a lynching on that person? On that person's husband or wife, on that person's children, on that community, because this is damage that was done. How do you make these calculations here? There was one of the stories that really struck me in reading about us was there was a group of Africans on this plantation, and they had to bring their children with them, the little babies with them, and they weren't allowed to keep the babies with them, so they had this kind of a gully where there were trees and there was shade there. So they would leave their baby safely in this space so they would be in shade while, you know, the parents were out there working in the fields. And a thunderstorm was on the horizon, and they saw it, and they asked to be able to go to get their babies and come back, you know, and then they continue to work. And they were told no, they were not allowed to go and get their babies.
the storm came, and it was like this flash flood. And at that point in time, they stopped asking. They just broke for the babies. By the time they got there, the gully was flooded. All the babies were dead. They had drowned. What's the price tag on that? How are we gonna? What kind of price are we gonna put on something like that in terms of this reparations thing? Because labor is not enough. The damage to the mind is what we need to focus on.
That's right. Okay, so that's right.
How do you put a number on the murder of self consciousness? How do you measure? Turn into a dollar figure mentor size per person. You know, we don't think about those things. It's like we're trying to escape this too. We're trying to run through this reparations thing, get us some money so we can all get back into bed with your roof.
Listen,
there's a major rush for that on the national, international level.
Yes.
Absolutely. Pan-African approach to this situation needs to be done because we have people, groups of African people, ethnic groups who no longer exist. How do you put a dollar figure on the Tasmanians?
Yep, genocide.
There are none of them. None of them are left. All of these people, the 280 million Africans, just from the Middle Passage, just from the point of capture to the arrival here, as calculated not only on the ones who were directly murdered, but the children who they were not able to bring into existence.
And
exponential growth.
People don't want to
want to do the nice soft touch, the soft shoe dance to this reparations thing where, you know, just get over it so we can go on about the business of being Yoruba, so we can go on about the business of being insane, so we can go about the business of being the one that we are not. You know, so for me, when we're talking about reparations, the conversations that I hear in general in our community, in organizations, they are extremely limited in terms of that word that you used, repair.
Yeah, and that's what it should be.
Just give something to somebody to some hush money. We're talking about trying to repair, repairing African people to the point where this cannot happen again. It can't be just, okay, we're happy, and then, I mean, I was talking to the students yesterday about being re-enslaved. There's nothing in the universe that African people can't be re-enslaved.
That's deep,
that,
Baba.
That, to me, is part of reparations.
Yeah.
We were at a point at one point in time where we could not be enslaved.
Mm-hmm.
We have to be returned to that. Okay, we can't just be returned to, even if we go back, we can't just be returned to the point of capture.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, where we were in the fields or we were doing this or we were working in the we have to go back to our greatness. We have to be taken back to that, or given the opportunity, given ourselves the opportunity to be in a position where we can be non-compromising, where we can pursue getting people out of our face. Because when we talk about those institutions that we need to build in order to repair ourselves, then you have to have it in such a way so that Yoruba or Negro agents cannot come in and corrupt it like they did Garvey.
Okay?
It has to be set up in such a way so that corruption, that corrosion cannot occur. Okay? I'm talking about winning. I'm not just talking about, you know, throwing some little more gas on the fire, whatever. I'm talking about us winning, because if we don't win as a result of reparations, you know, what's the point?
Yeah. Baba, we're going to take a break. And brothers and sisters, as many of you, just hold on. And for those who are in the queue, remember, if you want to, because when we come back from the break, we're going to open up for questions. And you hit star twice. And let me know that you want to have a question. You have a question, comment, or concern for Baba Baruti. So we're going to take this break. Brothers and sisters, you're listening to African Perspectives here on the Motherland Media Network, on timeforanawakening.com, and blocktalkradionetwork.com. Thank you for joining us. We'll be right back. You stay with us.
You are listening to African Perspectives with host Brother Oshi on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
last night, like a man that has something to prove. I dream about me a jet black babe, cause I think about life like that. Sugar, keeping my love on track, baby.
Listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters. Once again, you're listening to African Perspectives here on the Motherland Media Network on timeforanawakening.com and blacktalkradionetwork.com. Gary Taylor's My Blackness. That's for you, Baba. In fact, I just want to make this announcement. I'm going to make this announcement, and that is this is the 7th Annual Complementarity Conference coming up June 5th, Affirming African Love. And of, course, the quarterly men's gathering, Warriorhood, Healing, and Ma'at, that's going to be Saturday, May 8th. And I think there's another program you got coming up too, Baba.
Yes, there is. We have the Common Sense Security Conference.
Okay.
It's coming up. No, well, it's not Common Sense Security. It is Common Sense Security Lecture.
Okay.
And that on April the 24th. That's the 24th of this month.
Yeah, there it is. April 24th. So, you know, I get that information from you, and I'll be announcing that at every program. Also, too, this evening, the Association for the Study of Classical African Civilizations, ASCAC, is having their conference. It is from April 9th tonight all the way to the 17th. And, of course, tonight is the opening, and they have a lot of stuff planned. And tonight there will be presentations by the president of ASCAC, Brother Dr. Mario Beatty out of Howard University, and then the presidents or the chairs of the each conference, each region, the Midwest region, Eastern region. Of course, the Southern region is our dear sister, Dr. Reba Kelsey. And then they're going to be a short film on the sister who was the president of ASCAC for many years, Queen Nzinga Radebishi Haru. And then there'll be conversation. And then, of course, it starts tomorrow with the national at 1 o'clock. And there's nothing on, there's nothing on Monday. And then, and then it starts Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, and Friday evenings. And then next Saturday will be the close. And it's, you know, brothers and sisters, go to ASCAC. And this is Eventbrite, and it's free. This is free, brothers and sisters. This is free. And so you go to ASCAC 2021.eventbrite.com to register. ASCAC 2021.eventbrite.com. Bright is spelled B-R-I-T-E. Eventbrite.com, and make sure you are registered for the conference. So, you know, in this issue that we're talking about, and I mean, all our issues, the central theme, the common denominator is what Europeans have done to us, that many of us have been trained to believe that, you know, it is not happening, and our and the fault lies within ourselves, and as a consequence, we blame each other, you know, for these problems that we have, as opposed to putting the blame where it squarely belongs, on the perpetrators and who continue to destroy our minds. You know, we are at war for the minds of our people. That's why I do this program every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. And I talk about independence, self-determination, liberation, and sovereignty for African people. Because from my perspective and my understanding, there is no other discussion. Everything, damn it, else is moot. Our motto of this program is Pan-Africanism or perish, unify or die. The fact that all of this madness is happening to African people globally is because we lack that unity. Imagine if we would have been unified, not along any tribal area. Any petty differences and divisions, all that would be gone. We're talking about unity and purpose. We have a caller, Bob. Let me want to take this call.
Yes, okay. Absolutely.
334. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Boshi and pleasure to hear you. Large contingent of issues.
Hey, Baba. Hey, brother, you're breaking up on me. Can
you? Oh, goodness.
Yeah.
All right. How about now?
That sounds good. Go ahead.
Okay. Baba Baruti, could you entertain about feminism, homosexuality, and the political dogma coupled with capitalism as it pertains to the destruction of our will as Black people. I want to, you had mentioned about the creation of a formula. I look at it in terms of sets, right? And in basic set theory, you have these collections of objects. And particularly when you have two sets, you have that intersection. When you start to have three sets, you even have an even smaller but joint intersection, call that intersectionality of sorts, thinking about the good lawyer who created that term. So could you mention or give us brief words of how feminism, homosexuality, and political dogma coupled with capitalism has contributed towards kind of destroying the will of the African principle at this point?
All of these things, if I can speak in general terms, all of these things have created divisions, created even greater divisions within our community. Of course, that's always been the goal. Whenever you're sub-integrating a people into your nation or your society, and you don't want them to ever be in a position of power, well, then you have to fragment them. You have to atomize them. You have to break them up into smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller pieces. And these pieces have to be antagonistic toward the idea that they are a people and that they are one. Uh-huh. So all of the feminism, each of the things that you talked about moves you toward being an individual that's against the whole, moves you gotcha. Against other individuals who look like you. It's these are further fragmented. And when I think about them, I think about different forms of escapism. Escapism of being able to escape from being African, being able okay. to escape from having to be responsible for African people, for being accountable to African people. You're finding all of these other issues that are defined by other people as being your way, which is not your way.
That's right.
So feminism is not the way of African people.
That's right.
Homosexuality is not the way of African people.
That's right.
So you're taking on qualities and characteristics that describe somebody else.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I understand why Europeans are homosexual. I understand why Europeans are feminist. I understand that perfectly. It matches their history to the T, but it doesn't match our history. But we, because we see them as God sent, because we see them as being the authority on all issues and their interpretations of whatever our situation is as being more valid than an African-centered one, then we follow those distorted paths. And those distorted paths turn us against each other. Of course, capitalism, which is the Urugu economic system, and I've gotten to a discussion with this before, where people forget. Mount Amos and Wilson said, you know, the social relationships exist before any form of currency. That is your currency, your social relations. Those social relations determine the relations, economic relations between people. And we have to understand that capitalism came out of a particular mind. It came out of a particular mindset. Capitalism fits the European mind perfectly. The bureaucratic structure fits the European mind perfectly. So capitalism is designed to fragment. Now, for them, that's perfectly because it's like you can have a bunch of people who hate each other, but uh-huh. they can't collectively work to destroy another people. So you have a capitalist system where everything is highly individualized. Profit is highly individualized. Income is highly individualized. Everything is highly individualized, and you bring a people who are communal in nature into that system, and they become part of that, then they become the enemy number of themselves. So you have, we can go back and how Europeans had us believing that being a village was the worst possible thing for us because the village produced this hive mentality and you really didn't think as an individual. You only thought in terms of what you were told to think, like the Borg on Star Trek, which is the uh-huh. biggest lie because that's not what we were doing. That's not what we were about. But these systems that are in place that are normal and natural for Europeans, and they know that they're not natural for us. That's one of the reasons why they pull us in. Another reason, of course, is we serve as fodder. We serve as numbers for their battles. And, of course, the result of that is easily seen because when these battles are over, we're removed from the ranks of any kind of meaningful, power-filled leadership, and they assume the positions that they were going to assume before they came and brought us into the force. And we're all one. So they are extremely, not just a little, they are extremely divisive. So now you have within our community, you naturally had men and women who, you know, couldn't get along. It's difficult for, you know, marriage to work. It's difficult mm-hmm. for relationships to work mm-hmm. anywhere at any point in time. But then when you put in to that equation, feminism, capitalism, Nathan Hare and Julia Hare talked about that in a book called Black Sexual Politics.
And okay. There was an article in there that really talked about how all of these things work against us, and then you place into that mix racism. So the stress on the relations, not just complementary relationships between men and women, but all relationships get stressed. Okay. You know, so it's like all of these things work to fragment us. All of these things, and all people who adopt these practices, adopt these ways of thinking, adopt these philosophies, to me, they're escapists.
Got you.
Okay.
Thank you so very much. Thank you so very much. It's always a pleasure to hear from you, Baba Baruti. And thank you, Brother Oshie, for taking my call.
Your voice.
All right. Right on, Brother Lusk. Right on, dear brother. 646-646, good afternoon.
Hey, what's going on, Oshie? What's going on, Baba Baruti? How are you
Greetings.
Today?
Greetings. How you doing?
Hey, Jay.
Good. How is the Queen?
Everybody's good. I know your voice the second you start speaking as well.
How are you doing?
How's everybody doing?
Everybody's good. Baba, good. It's always an honor to hear your voice. I had to reschedule a meeting today to speak with you, Grand Elder. So wow. It's always an honor to hear your voice. I basically wanted to ask you, what is your take on this whole virus and vaccination and the manner in which the Yorugal is manipulating our people into taking something that may be a death threat?
And I think it's related whether it's real or not. And I've talked to some brothers about this before. This is a great example in this house of domains. I'm trying not to get off the subject, but this is a great example of domains where whenever I talk about common relationships, I say, you know, you have domains. Men and women have different areas in which they specialize in. And they may be my one man's specialization may be the same as some woman, but when you get together in a relationship, then you have domains because no one person is an expert in everything. So you allow, both of you allow the other person to be the expert in the area. And in this house, when it comes to health and spirituality, Inia, that's her domain. So when this thing kicked in, I immediately asked her, okay, well, how do we proceed with this? And she said, you know, no, public gatherings, no, blah, blah, blah. And I follow her guidelines based upon that because of the research that she has done relative to this, as well as the idea of what they may put into the air during these public gatherings. So, as I said, to be safe and sorry, but that really was not related to your answer, but I think people need to understand that concept of domains within relationships. But anyway, back to your point. Regardless of whether it's real or not, and I have encountered too many people in my family and other folks. In fact, there's a brother now who's one of the leading spokespeople on common relationships who's in the hospital at this moment having to deal with this. So there is something there. What it is, I don't know. I wouldn't even try to figure out. I know Yorugu's history in terms of, medical apartheid, to steal an author's name. In terms of them seeing us as guinea pigs in the military, in the prisons, in our homes, in the streets, on the African continent, defertilization of African women on the continent in massive numbers. I know that their agenda is genocide, if nothing else. So everything that they push on, if they're pushing something on us, for me, it's immediate suspect.
I say.
If they're in agreement with something, immediately it's suspect.
I say.
They want to go to war with somebody, immediately a suspect. If they support this particular candidate for Senate or Congress or mayor or council person, I am immediately suspect because I know that they are liars and I know that genocide is their main agenda relative to us. The problem with us is our gullibility based upon our mythicide. So mythicide teaches you. Mythicide makes you think that Yorugu is correct. Mythicide makes you believe that you should follow the instructions of Yorugu because Yorugu is the best scientist ever. Okay, even whether we're and even their colored spokespeople It's the same thing, because these people are speaking as an extension of Yoruba. They're not speaking on their own. They're speaking as an extension of Yoruba. Okay? And all of the things that have happened as a result, I mean, all the qualifications, well, you take the vaccination, you can still get, you know, the virus, you know, blah, blah. All of these contradictions in what they say, to me, is extremely problematic. I'm not taking the vaccine. Because I know them, and even if they said something, would say, I don't want any needle in them from them, because I don't know what they're putting in the needle, period. Okay, they could be telling you, they're giving you a flu shot, but they know who you are. They know who you are before you walk into that Walmart or the other drugstore to get your shot. They know who you are based upon your record, based upon your name. And they work together. If they didn't work together, we wouldn't be in the position that we're in. So because they know who you are, they know you're on this radio station. Okay, they know who you are. The folks who are complaining about, well, Yoruba spying on me, those are the ones who are, like, to me, the fake ones. Because if you're doing what you'll be doing, Yoruba's going to be spying on you anyway. So they know who you are, and they know they need to get rid of you because you are a voice, you are a questioner in this reality. Then they're going to make sure that every opportunity to remove you from existence. That's the history. All we got to do is look back at our history. Everyone who they were able to get their hands on, everyone they were able to get close to, every one of us who had a voice, they tried to remove. They tried to remove. And this process of genocide, I mean, I remember this from undergrad. We're talking about population. Of course, they don't want to talk about their population, but they want to talk about how many people they need to remove from this planet in order for sustainability to occur. Well, then remove yourself. Okay, but they're not pushing it on them. They're pushing it on us. They're pushing it on us more than, of course, anybody else. I'm not seeing them push it on the Asian community. I'm not seeing them push it on the Arab community. The only community I'm aware of that they are really pushing it on globally is us. So for me, like I said, to question, I'm going to question something. Hold on. Yeah.
Well, you know, Baba, I was expecting the answer that you gave.
Exactly.
Because I've told people there's only two people in this country that I would listen to if they said they were taking the vaccination. Then I would double think about it. That's you and my brother Kitty. And from the research that I done so far, it ain't no reason to. And then with the behavior of the Yoruba and the manner in which he won't allow alternative thoughts in regards to the vaccination along with the virus goes and show me that the Yoruba is behaving like the Yoruba.
Absolutely.
And once he does that, then you got to think twice. I just feel sad that our people are allowing themselves to get caught up in it in the manner in which they are, and are just willingly, it seems, to go along with it, because I don't know what it is. Maybe it's their fear of death. But like I always tell people, you have a date and a stamp, I believe, when you're going to leave this planet. And I don't think you're going to really be able to do too much to not have that go forward in the process of becoming an ancestor. So, you know, I'm just grateful that we have your eldership and your wisdom to come on and give that type of logical explanation on how we should move forward in dealing with something that the Yoruba has probably created to, like you said, deal in the manner of population control, because their empire is diminishing and about to crack and maybe go away, hopefully. And as always, Baba, it's just an honor and a privilege to hear you, man. And thank you again, Hotep. Please be safe. And look forward to the next time OC could get you to come back home and do what you do, as they say. Hotep, brother.
Absolutely. You do the same.
Right on, Jay.
He hits a nail on the head.
Yeah.
It's that mental thing, and it's painful.
Yeah, it is.
You know, not just COVID, not just the vaccination,
if you want to call it that. But, you know, so many other things, we see people, are people just walking towards death.
Mm-hmm. If anybody else wants to get in
this. Celebrating it because it's coming from Yoruba.
Yeah. If anybody else wants to get in this conversation, you're on the queue, then hit star twice and I'll let you in. And otherwise, give us a call at 215-490-9832. 215-490-9832. What you said earlier triggered something in me, which, you know, I love Muhammad Ali.
Mm-hmm.
I even boxed back in the 60s, you know, because I love Muhammad Ali in the late 60s. Mm-hmm. I love Muhammad Ali when he was Cassius Clay, you know, braggadocious, you know, picking around and so forth. But I must confess, I really love Muhammad Ali when he was speaking on issues affecting our people, challenging Caucasians. You are my opposer when I want freedom. I loved it. I loved that man standing up. He was the serious voice. And what was the image and how did America feel about Muhammad Ali? Of course, they stripped him of his title. You know, he would for 3 years of prime time with his box, you know, and then later, though, I believe when he went to the Mayo Clinic, in Minnesota, in the early 80s, they shot him up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how he got Parkinson's. You don't automatically get Parkinson's disease because you're boxing. There's a hell of a lot of boxers who've been hit a hell of a lot harder and more often than Muhammad Ali.
Right.
You know, that's what I believe. Mm-hmm. They silenced his voice.
Yeah,
they muted him. They made him a lovable, huggable figure. As opposed to the fiery brand man that he was, that challenges Caucasians. That's what I believe, and I will go to my grave with that notion. You know, in fact, a highlight. I met Muhammad Ali about 3 times in my life. I met him when he was with the Nation of Islam in Milwaukee at Muhammad's Mosque number 3. I was on the streets. Happened to be on the streets, and he was there. And then at his boxing, he has at Indiana Black Expo, which, by the way, I'm going to tell you about it, Bob, because it was a hell of an Indiana Black Expo, because I had lunch with Dr. John Henry Clark. And many other things were happening at the Indiana Black Expo, but Muhammad Ali has a boxing program there. In fact, Mayweather was on the card, Money Mayweather. Okay. But anyway, I saw him there. But the highlight is a friend of mine, we went to his center in Louisville. And I'm in there shadow boxing, I had my shoes off, I'm in there shadow boxing, just some of the things that you could do there. And she said, oh, she, hurry up, come here. I grabbed my shoes and there was Muhammad Ali. And he had had an operation on his neck. So he wasn't shaking as much as usual until later. And I had a chance to hug him, tell him I love him. Unfortunately, I did not have a camera. Didn't I have a cell phone camera at the time? But it's etched in my mind forever. And to me, I love that man. In fact, when he passed in June a few years ago, I went to the memorial service in Louisville. I was appalled of some of the people who spoke, particularly Bill Clinton. I can't stand the damn Clintons.
Yeah.
Such damn hypocrites. But I love
that. You want to claim.
Yeah. You know.
You want to claim.
So to
me, that's like anybody who speaks for us. I have questions about serious questions, and I believe that I can believe that something went wrong with what they did, that they did something with Harold Washington in Chicago.
Yes.
I firmly believe that. I stick to Nana Khalid's statement, you know, if anything happens to me, blame the white man.
That's right. Because I believe
too many of us are afraid to do that. We want all of this evidence.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, they're in control of in many cases.
Because
we can't believe. Well, we refuse to believe. We cannot accept that Yoruba is Yoruba.
Right, and how evil and devious he is because of the face that he puts on stuff. He's made you believe that he's moral, good. You know, people. That's just like the Caucasian who coined that phrase, Caucasian or white fragility. They don't want to believe that they're the evil people they are. They don't want to believe they took this country and dogged out the indigenous people and enslaved us. They don't want to believe that. They want to believe that what they did was good for humanity. The religion they brought to the world was good for humanity. That's their mindset. They don't want to believe the evilness, the wretchedness of themselves. You know?
Right. And that's one of the main reasons, And it's more than just money. That's one of the main reasons why they don't want their children anywhere near our story classes.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want their children anywhere near that truth. And when they find out what you're teaching, then they immediately run. They snatch their children, they run. And it's not because of it being a lie. It's because they know how your Rugal is going to respond, not only to that child, but to them,
mm-hmm.
for allowing that to occur. I used to say the and I think I said this on your program before, how the keeping children away from our correct education is, if they're not trying to protect the children, they're trying to protect themselves, because they know how Yorugu is going to respond to them, who's supposed to be responsible. It's like we're using our children as a shield,
mm-hmm.
against mm-hmm. Yorugu.
Mm-hmm.
So we're trying to make them even more user friendly than us. And the children, I mean, if they don't receive the truth, if they don't know, you know, when I was teaching college, it's like the same thing. And it's like, okay, these are supposed to be grown men and grown women who are learning at a liberal arts school, but they don't have the intelligence to listen to a professor and figure out for themselves whether that individual is speaking truth or not. So the school will remove anything that does not move or does not talk to the students in terms of turning them into better Negroes. You know, so I have no, my reading of history and my reading of our story tells me that nothing that comes out of Yorugu's mouth is going to be truth. It's going to be manipulative in some way. That's why I say the truth of liars.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why I
because
say.
What they say, if it is the quote unquote truth, then it's said in such a way that it still benefits them, mm-hmm. and works against us.
Yeah. Yeah, that's why I say that, as Malcolm said, and I don't know if Elijah Muhammad said, but whatever, of all our studies, history is best qualified to reward our research. Look at the
Absolutely.
History, objectively. Look at the history of what's happened to us. You know, that's like, when you just mentioned Harold Washington, and I said that, mm-hmm. and one brother said, no, well, Harold Washington smoked and drank a lot. You know? Well, you know,
I want to always say, who doesn't?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But I look at Bobby Wright, Dr. Mm-hmm. Bobby Wright. I look at Dr. Mm-hmm. Amos Wilson. You know,
yeah,
a lot of our yep. strong African-centered independent scholars and researchers mm-hmm. and individuals and politicians who spoke on these things, I look at them. And to mm-hmm. me, you know, I put nothing past these folks because, once again, look at the history.
Absolutely.
Look at what they've done. That should Absolutely. Tell you. Look at the history. But see, our problem mm-hmm. is as African people, and when I speak of African people, I'm talking about globally. I ain't just talking about mm-hmm. here in Atlanta, here in the United States, or in the Caribbean. I'm talking about us as African people globally. We have mm-hmm. been so whitewashed, so inculcated, you know, mm-hmm. that our minds, you know, mm-hmm. are so messed up. And the reason why we are suffering consistently globally, wherever we are, as Dr. Clark said, we have no friends. We have
right,
no
absolutely.
Friends everywhere. And yet we have been absolutely. Good to people who have come into Kemet when it was a shining example. We didn't kick them to the curb. You know, we allowed them to come in.
Right.
You know,
absolutely.
You know, yeah, because we're people who embrace others. Man,
absolutely.
You know, that is not who we are. You know,
right. absolutely.
Job pointed that out.
People like this. You know, it amazes me the number, how deep the menticide is in terms of not wanting to know things like that, mm-hmm. where you, so many of us are afraid of touching anything that's African or reading anything that's African or being in the presence of anything that's African, because we know in the back of our head, we know that Yorugu will kill for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
He got a zillion ways to do it. And that's why all of these murders don't surprise me. All of these quote-unquote deaths don't surprise me. He's got like a zillion ways to do this.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't want to touch anything that may make them think of the African, because they are afraid that it will make them act. And they know that if they act, then that's a death sentence. They know that in their minds, that's suicide.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to stay away from things that may bring consciousness to them, because they don't want to be conscious because of that fear. They know Yorugu, even though that's not part of discussion. They'll say, well, you know, everything is fair. No, you can't believe that Yorugu had anything to do with Muhammad Ali's death, blah, blah, blah. No, they know in the back of their mind. They know in the back of their mind. They know in their subconscious
very much in the subconscious. Like Amos Wilson said, you know, nothing that you learn, nothing that you see, nothing that you experience, you know, ever goes away. It still impacts your life.
Mm-hmm.
They know you, Rugu. They are in denial of their own knowing, but they know you, Rugu. They know you, Rugu, clearly. And they know that they need to stay away from anything that has even the remotest possibility, like a slave, has the remotest possibility of awakening them because it may cause them to do something. Okay? Slave doesn't ask. Slave doesn't ask any questions because they are so afraid of the answer and that the person who they're asking or the person who's responsible for the answer, they don't know how they're going to respond, but they know that that response can come, can reach the point where it kills them. So they're very much afraid. So we're walking around, we're saying menticide, but menticide, to me, is very much interchangeable with the word slave. Slave mentality.
Yeah.
You're afraid to breathe wrong in front of your Rugu. And you may get loud, blah, 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 because you've been in this area. But once your Rugu stands up and frowns, the discussion is over.
Mm-hmm.
Discussion is over. The fear kicks in. So we are still a people, no matter how we want to play it. We're still a people who are very afraid, very much afraid. We're afraid of death. Uh-oh. That's also a slave mentality, mm-hmm. because a slave will do anything to avoid, not an enslaved person, but a slave will do anything to avoid that death. As I said, they'll here take my wife, take my children, you know, take my house, take my car, just let me live.
Mm-hmm.
That's a slave mentality
that
most of us have. So whenever an issue comes up, like Muhammad Ali, or whenever a situation comes up, like COVID, we are deferring to whatever Yorugu's interpretation of it is, or mm-hmm. whatever they say we should think, or whatever we think we should say that will go good with them, that will be safe with them.
You know what was funny? And Brother Sean, hold on, Brother Sean. I'm going to come to you in a second. But what was interesting is with this virus, I remember one cat had a sign up. He said, I understand what happened in Tuskegee, but this is for Caucasians to correct the wrong. I was like, Negro, please.
Oh,
I was like, Negro, please. But, you know, all
the
other.
He was sitting in the chair.
Yeah. He was sitting in the chair.
I'm like, those are my words, too.
Yeah, Negro, please. You know, and then all the other things that they have done to us, the experiments, all the other things. Henrietta Lacks, you know, using her. Brother Sean, go ahead.
Okay. hi. Good morning. Thank you for your guest. I got a little bit of noise in the background. Someone's mulling, so I'm going to be quick. One of my questions I have, just comments, and then I'll leave to listen to your response, is that, you know, we came here as Africans hundreds deep on boats. And I'm kind of wondering, like, what is stopping us from creating our own vessels out here in the Western Hemisphere, and just sailing from North America throughout the islands all the way to like Brazil and South America, and then just sailing back. Like, it took us months on those wooden rickety ships crammed up to get here. If we have some kind of modern version of a vessel that we can fit 500, 1,000 people, Black people, African people, comfortably, if we can sail back on the Atlantic, not fly, but sail on vessels that we are upkeeping, and sail back to Africa. Do you think that that's feasible? Do you think that, I mean, you know, Garvey mentioned Black Star Line. Do you think that we can really, I mean, African people in the West, that we can really get a real naval cargo merchant class, like vessels, to hold, you know, material in us, to regularly sail back and forth across the Atlantic? Because again, we came here on boats, and although a lot of people fly back in a plane, you know, it's not the same, man. I think that the best way for African people to heal is to be able to go back collectively like we were, you know, of our own volition. You know, we didn't come here by choice, but we should be able to go back hundreds deep. And it might take a couple weeks because it's still on boat. It's not quick like a plane, but I just want to know what your thoughts are on that. And I'll hang up, and I appreciate your work. Thank you.
Thank you, Brother Sean.
Well, and technically, I don't think that there's anything stopping us from doing that. There are a lot of problems. think anything is wrong with that. Let me make that point clear. I don't think anything is wrong with that. I don't think anything is stopping us from doing that. But there are some things that are stopping us from doing that. Some of them have to do with the mentality of African people here. So that group would probably be a very select group of individuals. Number one, the vast majority of us don't see Africa as home. We don't see any connection to Africa whatsoever. We don't want to be associated with Africa whatsoever. We cringe when somebody calls us an African. I've had people cringe when I said the word African without African American. Okay, and I don't say African American.
I don't either.
So the mentality that a lot of us have here, the mentality of a lot of Africans on the continent, and most of these mentalities are a creation of European culture and society, and neither one of these statements prevents my first point that nothing is stopping us from doing that. But we have to consider, you know, Garvey started the Black Star Line, but what happened to that Black Star Line? We have to be able to do that. Say we wanted to do that. We have to be able to do that in such a way that those things that were done to Garvey won't be done to this larger fleet of ships. That the traitors, the treasonous individuals in our midst who pretend to be with us, that they won't be able to corrupt and destroy that process like they were able to do with the Honorable, you know, Garvey. Also, again, you have to be received. You have to be well received. So a situation would have to occur there so that significant numbers of Africans could go. You also have to consider what we would be taking back. Okay, we need to take back the best of us. Initially, I would argue, the most skilled of us, initially, I would argue, so that we can assist in the process of assisting our brothers and sisters there who are not our inferiors, who are not less than us, in building the type of society that allows everybody, you know, to be African and allows us to begin to move back in that direction. But there are problems with that, and most of the problems have to do with mentality. But there's nothing to prevent us to do that. We have the capital to do that. We have the capital wealth. We have the income to do that. We have enough people to do that, to create a steady stream. And with time, maybe that stream would affect other folks. I kind of doubt it, because there are some people who would rather be around Urugu, rather die than not be around Urugu, would rather die than not be under Urugu's domination. You know, there are other reasons why. But I understand what you're saying. I understand the urgency in your voice as well, in terms of this needs to be done. But we also just take one aspect of the problem. That's with communication. We are so involved in stupidity in terms of discussions that would turn into simply, well, it already is, would turn into simply a meaningless, distracted debate online, where the people who are involved in the discussion just carry the discussion further and further, and discussion gets larger and larger until it fizzles out. So in order to do this, you have to have a group of people, such as yourself, who would say, let's do this now. We don't need a lot of conversation on this. If we're going to do it, then let's do it. Let's not spend the next 20, 30 years talking about it until it becomes a non-issue. So if it's going to be done, that's also part of the problem. It needs to be done fairly immediately. Folks need to get on it fairly immediately. We have been trained in the West. What did the Chemite said, the Greek language was one of noise and confusion. That's a language that we have adopted. So we're walking around engaging each other in noise and confusion instead of actually doing things which can benefit us, like providing. And I think the ships crossing the ocean would be an excellent idea, because then you get a feel. You get a feel for what the ancestors dealt with. We need to take the long way. We need to, and I'm not talking about cruise ships where you're sitting there playing.
Yeah,
the entire show. I'm talking about we get out there and we're thinking and we're talking and we're understanding and we're feeling to get us back. You don't rush into greatness.
You know, this situation that we're in, Baba, and I appreciate you and all the things that you consistently do to prepare ourselves, to prepare young warriors to take the mantle up, to, you know, and I understand that what those of us of this mindset are unfortunately a fringe, and I hate that, because it's the exception as opposed to the rule, you know.
True.
And but still, this exception, I'm hoping that continues to grow. and be the model for us as a people. I understand that the vice grip that the European has on our minds, there are many of us that want it released. They want to maintain that. They want to consistently gain favor with Urugu. They want to consistently live a lifestyle and so forth. Because, see, this society is bad for, it's not conducive for us. When you have a society based on individualism, materialism, greed, and violence, you know, that's not conducive. That's not conducive to relationships. That's why, you know, I respect and admire and love the relationship between you and NEI and all the other brothers and sisters who have their compliments, who are working together for family. I love that and love more of it. And we need more of it as an example. But in the general society, no, it's not like that, because this society doesn't promote good relationships. It doesn't promote family, you know, especially our families. Especially us, because our family, if our family structure was to be maintained and to be strong, we wouldn't be in this damn mess.
Absolutely.
You know? So.
Absolutely, Bob.
Yeah. So, you know, we have a lot of work to do to rid ourselves. Yeah, to rid ourselves of this evil mindset that we have. And, and some of us don't understand it because, you know, we don't want to deal with it. You know, it's you know, it's uncomfortable. Like I said, you know, with that saying, if we knew better, we do better. Yeah. But a lot of us don't want to know. We don't want to know better. We want to maintain the this foolishness that Urugu has imposed upon us and this insanity. We want to maintain that as opposed to purging ourselves or getting rid of that mindset and infusing ourselves with knowledge of self and a sense of wholeness, a sense of love and respect for each other, our women, our families, our community, to change that. We don't want to do that, you know?
Sure.
Well, we only have a couple of minutes, Bob, and I know you got to go, so you go ahead and do a little wrap up here. And once again, I know the brothers and sisters who are listening and those who had an opportunity to there have been a lot of people who have called and a lot of people who are online. So I want to thank all of those. But more importantly, I want to thank you, brother, for your constant.
Bravo, it's an honor to be on here.
You know,
Bravo Oshie, we have, you know, you are special in our home. And I mean that in the most positive way. There's never been a conversation where your name came up where there was something negative associated with the conversation.
Right on.
We have an enormous amount of respect for the work that you're doing. I think that's something that really needs, in a way, needs to close this out, because people need to recognize the dedication. What is number one, what's required to run a Negro radio program? You know, that takes a lot. But we're talking about an African-centered program. In an anti-African reality, and you've taken this bull by the horns, and you have ridden that bull well. You have brought to those folks who want to listen, who want to know, who want to learn, who want to think, who want to feel good about being who they are. You've made that into an institution in the community, and we definitely appreciate that. And I believe everybody who is here believes in the importance of what you are doing, and that should be honored. That's very important now. So many voices have been silenced. So many good voices have been silenced. So to be in the presence of one that is serious about this work, who's non-compromising, who's willing to bring on voices that are not going to be popular, but are not going to lie to people, that are going to speak this truth for us, I'm honored to be on here. And NEI feels exactly, you know, the same way. She's honored for me to be on here, because everything is coming out of my mouth. This isn't coming out of my mouth. We've been together for so long.
Right.
Most
on.
Of it is from mine.
That's right.
You know, so, Barbara, you know that this is an honor to be on, and I'm not just saying that because that's a proper thing to say. It's an honor to be on. I'm glad to be on, and I appreciate the folks who called in. I appreciate the questions very much, and I'm looking forward to the next time.
Right on. And I am too, Baba. Believe me, I am. I thank you so much. Brothers and sisters, we end this program like we end all of our programs with the words of Stephen Biko. The most potent weapon in the hands of the oppressor is the minds of the oppressed. This program is dedicated and committed to helping to free the African mind. But not just the M-I-N-D, but the M-I-N-E, because under the feet of African people lies all of the resources that everybody wants. think they can't do without, and they sure in the hell, damn it, don't want to pay for it. Brothers and sisters, you have a blessed and wonderful day. Shemhotep means go in peace. Asantesana means thank you. Bibi Vahardie. Bibi Vahardie means our victorious destiny. Brothers and sisters, we will be victorious. You have a safe and wonderful weekend, family. Blessed.